You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Government policy has a cost. Every law and regulation passed by the government has a human toll. The Cost, a series of We Are Libertarians, is a one-on-one interview that tells the story of an average person as they deal with the outcome of policy. I'm Chris Spangle. This next episode of The Cost was recorded in 2014 with my friend Woody and his wife Linda Martell, and Greg Lenz was there also. We interview Woody about his daughter, who was put into prison for selling a few pills and got 16 years, which ended up being a death sentence. You'll hear the inhumane treatment that she received as over 100 people saw Rachel dying and only one person acted. Just a little update to the story, Woody ended up suing and has already won one of the malpractice cases and is moving through the court system with the others. We'll talk to Woody soon and give you an update on his story, but through the process of discovery in the lawsuit, he has found that many people knew about Rachel's condition and it is all documented. Rachel could have received help, but few people did anything. So now here is Woody's story.
Woody, how did we meet? We're going to talk, to give people a brief overview of what we're going to talk about today. Woody and I met a few years ago, and there was a situation with his daughter, and we're going to talk about the cost of privatizing prisons and privatizing services. And I know I've alluded to Woody's story on the podcast in the past, but we want to tell Rachel's story, to put it out there so people understand the cost of some of these privatizations and the failures at some of these levels, when most of us as libertarians would think that privatization would be a good thing. There's very real human costs involved in this. And right off the bat, I want to say that we're going to have a petition in the description of this podcast. You can find it at wearelibertarians.com on our Facebook page. And we want you to go sign the petition, and we want you to share this story. We want you to share it with your friends and family. So to be frank, we want it to go viral because we want people to understand the costs that go along with some of this. And it's been, do you have any idea what year we might, was it 2012,
yeah.
2013, early 2013? April 13th, 2012, and we met around that time in 2013. So, Woody, why don't you tell the, just kind of, it's going to be a kind of a tough podcast to listen to, I think. We're all a little tense already just from the brief conversation. Woody's daughter was arrested. She had a complicated blood disease. Went to prison. It wasn't treated properly by the private medical company that the government contracted to take care of Rachel and other inmates in Indiana. And Rachel died on April 13th, 2012. And we're going to talk about that story and the cost there. And, you know, first off, we haven't reached out to Corizon. We haven't reached out to the state of Indiana. Woody's just a personal friend. What Woody says is his opinion. What Linda says is her opinion. The same for myself and Greg. You know, I have personally combed through all the documents that Woody has. I've helped go to meetings with lawyers with Woody. I've helped set up a lot of stuff. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that what he says can be verified by fact, at least most of it. Now, some of his opinions, Woody, you'll get to know, he's a little unfiltered. if you think Maya's a ball buster, wait till we get Woody on the podcast to give me crap. But so how did we end up getting in touch? What was the catalyst for you getting in touch with me?
Well, I couldn't get nobody from the government to listen. I kept getting excuses. So I was going through the internet and I was thinking, you know, who's going to run for office? That needs some something that they can get involved with that's going to help them. So when I started looking on the internet, your name came up. So I read a little bit about you, and that's when I made a phone call to you. And about after 3 or 4 days, I figured, well, that's probably another wasted call. But you did call me back, and we met, and and went from there.
And you tried reaching out to Republicans, Democrats, reporters, government yes. officials at yep. every level.
Yes.
Long after everything had gone on, almost a yes. year later, over the course of a year, just trying to get somebody to listen to your story. Can you talk about some of the people that you reached out to that the doors were just kind of closed?
Who was our... Delaney. Yeah, I called his office several times. His co-worker or the gentleman, I think his name is Mark.
Your state representative.
Right, this is right. my state representative. And I'm just thinking the gentleman's name, but he said, oh, Mr. Laney would want in this. This is right before election. Yes, he's interested. He wants to talk to you. But I did forget on what day, time, and year he wanted to do this because my doors were slammed every time I contacted him. He would always say, well, yeah, he does want to talk to you, but he never did. He never reached back to me. Daniels, same way.
The governor of Indiana at the time.
Governor of Indiana, same way. I was reaching out to him before Rachel passed away, and it was blank. May as well talk to a wall.
Right. You know, before Rachel passed away, you tried to get in touch with the ombudsman, the yeah. head of the Department of Corrections,
oh,
the
yes.
head of all these prisons.
Yes.
What media did you reach out to, you know, over the course of that year? And what, you know, the problem, as somebody who's been in politics and who worked in media in different forms, you get a lot of these stories, and it's hard to tell who's telling the truth, and it's very it's time-consuming, it's complicated, it's emotional, and you've got 7 hours to spend on a story because you've got to hit a deadline. So you get these stories, and you go, well, that's tough. So on to Indy's top singles here in town.
Our top 10 list.
Right, our top 10 list of the best-dressed politicians in Indiana. You know, so it can be hard to even get the media to listen to a
yes.
story where
yeah.
we're a
yeah,
situation.
They didn't want it.
Yeah, and to be frank, when we first met, you had no idea what happened to Rachel, how she passed away, what caused it, and it wasn't until we kind of put together with a friend of mine who has gone to medical school that could explain some of that. And when you can't succinctly give the story in 5 minutes to a reporter, they don't listen. I mean, so how, in your interactions with the media, did you find that to be true?
What I did with the media, and you know, well, is I had boxes of documents from Corizon, from the prisons, to prove everything I said. It backed up the autopsy, even backed up and said to give a list of the medications that are in the body and give what the body's supposed to take. And like one, the body was only supposed to have 240. She had 3,660 in her. They had tranquilizers in her just trying to shut her up. She couldn't walk. But anyway, with all these documents, the media still didn't want it because it's a hard story to tell without something backing you up, and I have the documents, every one of them, the autopsy, what did they say final at the end? What was the, Linda?
Therapeutic misadventure.
Yeah, therapeutic mm-hmm. misadventure. And that's a screw up from the doctors and hospitals. And
right, so one candidate in Indiana, Rupert Bonham, the guy from Survivor that everybody laughed off as a joke, one of his key platforms in 2012 when he ran for governor was treating prisoners humanely, fair sentencing, that criminals are human beings too, as opposed to Mike Pence, who said, you know, it's great applause line, but not necessarily good policy, that if you commit a crime in Indiana, it should be the worst place in the nation to do so, and we're going to lock you up and throw away the key, and we're going to privatize as much as we can. You know, where Rupert has worked with people in and out of the criminal justice system, and you've told me that Rupert being in the debates, you hearing that, hearing a libertarian give an alternate viewpoint, kind of gave you the idea that maybe you'd want to reach out to somebody who was a libertarian, and that's
right.
how you eventually got.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct. Yeah, because the Democrats and Republicans kind of try to sweep it underneath the rug. So, you know, like I said, when I went on the internet and looked, it came up libertarians. And then I started reading down through there, and your name was in there quite a bit.
Yeah, I know.
President.
I do my best. Hey, everybody, listen to me. So we started talking, and it did take me a couple weeks to get back to you, but I finally met you, and you know, you invited me over to the house, and you know, you invite me over to your house, I just go over to a stranger's house and hang out, and then you bring a box of documents, and we start looking it over, and you tell me the story, and it just, you know, you had been working with a lawyer for a very long time.
Several different lawyers.
And Woody is tough on lawyers. This is the guy that you want heading up the bar association. I'm telling you. Like, nobody gives lawyers more crap than this guy here. This one legitimately so. He was just... a lot of times you'd think that a lawyer would hear this story, hear the situation, and want to help their client get justice. This particular person, in my opinion, without naming names, was spinning the wheels, racking up the hours, not doing a darn thing, right. and exploiting the situation to almost missing deadlines because, you know, when we first met, therapeutic misadventure essentially means medical malpractice. And
what a creative name.
Yeah, isn't that creative? And there are time limits, statute of limitations for you to file certain things. And this guy was going to let some of that pass.
Right.
There are a couple of different lawsuits on two different levels that are currently pending that we're not going to really get into. We're just going to kind of stick to the story that I have seen the documents for. Because we don't want to affect the outcomes. Now, so right up front, want to be honest, what are the two lawsuits that you're currently, that you filed about this situation?
Malpractice and civil rights.
Right. So you were suing medical malpractice, both Corizon, the doctors involved, nurses.
Several doctors, several nurses.
Several facilities.
Yeah. Several facilities.
So Corizon plus the hospitals that she was in.
And then filing a civil rights suit.
Against all them and the state.
And the state, which is that's a federal level.
No, that's at state level.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Arizona has one of those pending as well. The ACLU filed it against Corizon.
Against Corizon. And we'll get into this.
Who does?
The ACLU.
Oh.
But
if you look up Corizon, though, there's
only
hundreds,
lawsuits.
Hundreds, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll get to Corizon in just a minute, but what, and feel free to be honest about this, what is the reason that you filed these lawsuits? Because I think people hear that and they go, oh, well they're out for money.
Well, the reason I filed the lawsuits, you know, I'm a grieving father and still am, and always will. I wanted revenge, and to me, lawsuits is not the way to get it. Revenge. Revenge is somebody needs to be held accountable for and go to jail.
Right.
Until I talk to you.
you've alluded to BP.
Yeah, yeah. So
explain the BP analogy that you shared with us earlier.
Well.
Meaning people...
He believes that when the oil spill happened and BP arrest or had their two vice presidents got arrested for it as negligent, that's what we'd like to see.
Yeah, because...
If we got true justice, somebody would go to jail for what they did.
Because they arrested these guys because they knew there was a problem in that oil well.
Right.
And they ignored it. Now, what's the difference here... With Rachel, Corizon knew it, our government knew it, and they ignored it.
Yeah.
And then...
And we'll get into all that in just a moment.
I mean, that's just like GM. Now they're talking about arresting them because they knew ahead of time. What's the difference here?
Right.
I mean, if you can explain to me so I can understand, then I'd be all right. But I don't think there's any way that can happen.
So we met, and you know, you and I talked about you starting a grassroots campaign to get people arrested, and which is sort of something we're beginning today. you know, you also talked about you know, going and lobbying your state legislators, which you had tried, and I gave you the advice that you should sue. And now I've always been a person that believes that, generally, what I think most of us think, if you sue for medical malpractice, if you sue for these things, you're that people are generally out for money. But you know, the more that I really thought about it, Rachel was legitimately wronged. It's very clear in the documents that you have. And what language do these people speak? It's money. We don't have a legal system that allows for the proper justice for this family or for, you know, the restitution that they'd like to see, which is people being arrested for their daughter dying unnecessarily.
Yeah, but if you know, if my child was under my care and they died, I'd be held responsible.
Mm-hmm.
What makes them above me? What
right.
makes them better than me?
Right.
They're not. We're supposed to be equal.
Right. And it was my advice to you to get a new lawyer and start
yes,
looking into lawsuits.
Yeah, because that was the furthest thing from my mind.
Right. So taxpayers, you can thank me.
Well, I mean, it's a sad state of affairs that in the private prison system, lawsuits are your only system of accountability, transparency.
Yeah, but your attorney general makes that decision if it goes to court or not. If he would have took the time and investigated like his job is supposed to be, then we wouldn't be having all this. He'll say, yes, we were in the wrong. I'm sorry, this is law, so we're going to end this right now. But no, he likes to do every case that goes in front of him. He does not inspect them, you know, investigate it all. He automatically turns it over to some lawyer and say, fight him. So, no, there's taxpayers' money wasted.
They only want sure things.
Yeah.
They only want laydowns.
So you did go to try and keep the state accountable.
Yes.
You went and filed a tort claim.
Yes.
And what was the result of that? And can you explain what that is, the process?
A tort claim
happened?
Is something you gotta file. To let them be aware that a suit's coming. Now, when this all went to the attorney general, he's supposed to look at that, turn it over to somebody in his office to investigate it and then advise him which way to go. I guess this is how they do it. They sit down and talk, or they've got their minds made up before it's investigated. But then he makes the decision if it goes on to court or if they settle right now.
Okay.
So he chose, with all the documents saying and showing everybody was in the wrong, that, you know, we're
well, we
take
hadn't
it to
even
court.
Shared those documents with them yet. They made the determination that it was I can't remember the exact words, but it was basically an invalid claim without any discovery.
Yeah, now they did not look at any of these papers, okay? And this reminds me of when I tried to do this by myself. I went after the Terre Haute prosecutor because that's the hospital she was at. He kept ignoring my phone calls, so I left him a sweet message stating that either you call me or the media will call you. Well, in 10 minutes, he was on the phone talking to me.
Sure.
It's kind of funny how people jump when the media is involved.
I have a friend, close friend who has a very serious legal situation, very dangerous situation, talked to 9 different government agencies to try and get help. No one would help her until she showed up to the Channel 6. 10 minutes later, there's a police officer there to take a statement. Unfortunately, if you're listening and you have friends or family or acquaintances who are in these kind of tough situations, that's leverage, man. Call Rafael Sanchez at Channel 6 or Kara Kenny or... you know, your local investigative team at your local paper, your local TV station, and you'll get answers a lot of times.
Yeah, but a lot of them on this case blew it off. They didn't want it.
Right.
Like 59 and all them, they didn't want it.
They didn't. So, they didn't. They wanted the story as long as they didn't bring the government, and they didn't bring Horizon, and they didn't bring any sort of political
agenda.
So they wanted it as a public interest story. We're not interested in sharing the story just to share our grief. We're interested in, we want change.
Then
accountability.
All right.
Right.
And then that prosecutor in Terre Haute says, okay. He goes, I understand. I'm so sorry about your loss. I'll have an investigator get a hold of you. Well, not giving any names, but a state officer called and got my side of the story. And then 2 days later, he called me up and says, well, I'm done. I said, wow, that's pretty quick. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing. Nobody did anything wrong. I said, really? 2 days? You're pretty good, sir. And can I have a copy of that report? And he said, sure can. I'll email it to you. Well, for one, he couldn't spell her name right, didn't get her birthday right, didn't get her age right. So that kind of tells you where his mind and everybody was going on over there in Terre Haute area on an investigation. They
yeah.
didn't care.
So let's talk a little bit about Corizon. Let's get into the details here. So we've given kind of an overview of what we're going to talk about. Let's talk about who is Corizon. It's not just the only company out there that does this, but we're using them as sort of we're making an example of them for what goes on in a lot of our different prison systems, and a lot of so-called freedom Republicans. Well, push for this kind of privatization. Who is Corizon, Greg?
Corizon is a company. It used to be Correctional Medical Services, and then in 2011 they merged with PHS, Private Health Systems or Prison Health Systems, also known as PHS Correctional Healthcare. That was their largest competitor. So now they are the 800-pound gorilla in the room. No one's close. They're in 28 states. They're private, and they have over $1.5 billion in annual revenue.
Yeah, but sure. They're being dropped in some of the states.
They've lost some. They're getting ready to lose Florida if they don't conform on an audit. They're having the same issues that clearly you've encountered. Arizona has an ACLU lawsuit against them, and they have had more prisoners die by an average of about 40% from 2010 to 2012 since contracting out to them.
Sure. So
now, isn't most of that money leaving this state? I mean,
They're based out of they're in Brentwood, Tennessee. Originally, they were in Missouri, but since they merged, they became the major player.
And I believe they're getting $350 million from Indiana.
And so the way it works is this, is they look at, and I've actually in Indiana, I just started doing some investigating to see how do they get in? Essentially, who's their contact? What they do is they hire people.
By the way, guys, Greg's the one who knows stuff on this show. So that, go ahead. Yeah.
So in 2011, they ended up hiring an individual named Bob Burns here in Indiana. Bob Burns, prior to being the regional director for Corizon, actually had a small correctional management company called Correctional Management Company. But prior to that, he was superintendent of the Department of Correction for 21 years. Uh-huh. So they hired the guy that created the system. Then he started a for-profit system once it looked like it'd be privatized. He made money. Corizon bought them out with his business partner, who was the legal counsel for the Department of Correction for 21 years.
What state is this?
Indiana.
Okay. All right.
So it makes it pretty easy to have the governor's phone number on speed dial when you just go around hiring his appointees and winning contracts, which in many states there's no competitor. So there's a lawsuit right now in the state of Tennessee going on because the Corizon hired the person who awards the contract. It's a procurement lawsuit going on right now.
Right.
So they hired a guy whose wife got a VP job with Corizon, essentially the job Bob Burns has here. Mm. And they hired her. Oh, of course not. Even though their bid was $15 million more than that next competitor, there was no wrongdoing.
Right.
I'm sure it wasn't influenced at all. It's only, you know, husband and spouse. Right. That's pretty much their standard operating procedure. They go around offering somewhere between probably $185,000 to $300,000 a year jobs. They're a private company, so they're probably intent on going public, so they dangle stock options at you in equity. Once it goes public, you're a millionaire with a mid-six figures job. You just make sure the contract always is retained.
So what does the contract say that their function is?
So they are to provide...
Explain user experience.
Okay, so user experience is, instead of the prisons hiring their own doctors, nurses, medical practitioners, they outsource it to a third-party provider. So now they have quote-unquote oversight and agreements in place for what they're supposed to provide. And then they establish with the state it's a per diem. And the per diem in Indiana over this period is $9.41 per prisoner, with a cap of about $293 million over a three-year period from January 2014 through the end of 2016.
Okay.
So $9.41 per day.
Do we have any idea, and maybe this is a question I should have asked you before we started this podcast, but do we have any idea what, like, what is the average cost of an American's health care per day? I mean, it can't be $9, especially, you know, when we get into kind of what Rachel suffered from, it definitely was not $9. It was far more than that, I'm sure.
No, and especially with the baby boomers being the largest demographic, you would have to be closer to $26, $27 per day
right.
when you factor it all the way out. And keep in mind, most of that's tax dollars because another large majority are on Medicaid. And Medicaid's not they don't administer it. You know, they still have doctors that do it, but they say this is what you get and that's it.
So we have a situation, we've talked about this before, but let's reiterate it. How does a company show profit? If they need to make a profit, they do it in three or four ways, okay? Number one is they cut back what profit shares they give back to their stockholders.
Yep.
Now we've talked about how they don't want to do that because they want to maybe take the company private.
And then buy all their competitors.
And then buy all their competitors and charge a premium. You can cut
fixed costs.
Cut fixed costs, which you can't because you're locked into a $350 million deal for how many years?
It goes through 2016 and the option to renew for two periods after that for 2 years.
All right. So it was a 5-year contract?
It's three with the option for seven.
Three. Okay. They're locked into a 3-year rate. That's what they're getting because it's a government monopoly. Let's be honest. When we talk about government privatization in this day and age, it's a monopoly. It's a government-sanctioned monopoly. And personally, I'm all for privatizing assets. You know, the toll road, the parking meters here in Indiana, go for it, whatever. You know, it's just another way the government's screwing it up. But when we're talking about human lives, it's a different situation. So they're at a fixed cost with this government monopoly. So they can't cut shareholders' shares. They can't cut the
you can't have
what they
one
charge.
Doctor for an entire prison.
Right.
That's a, you know, a GP in trying right. to do eye surgery.
Right. And then
but they have one hospital.
Yeah, one hospital is what they do to essentially control costs.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because they drove Rachel from one end of the state, as critical she was, clear to the by ambulance to the other end of the state.
Right.
That's another thing they're in trouble for. They're doing it with pregnant women. They're taking them from Plainfield to Anderson, Indiana to give birth.
Which is a two-hour drive.
Not their hospital.
Which is a two-hour drive. And
yeah. It's so, just for... All right. Yeah.
So the third way that you show profit is you cut jobs and you take... you pay less, you cut jobs, and you cut services. In this situation, you know, in a business, you pay your people less, you... don't provide them as many benefits, you don't provide as good of a service. And that's exactly what's happened in this case. In my opinion, the way that Corizon is showing a profit is they're cutting the services to the most vulnerable. The people who don't have the option to leave the hospital and go to, you know, you can't go from Eskenazi here in town to St. Vincent's to St. Francis to community. You know, the four hospitals here in town, you don't have that choice. You're in prison. You're stuck and you're at the mercy of what the prison guards and what the state has contracted with this company. And if there is a problem, who's going to believe them? Because they're criminals anyways, right? And again, I would refer you all to go watch the documentary The House I Live In on Netflix or I don't know if it's on Netflix currently on streaming, but look it up and watch The House I Live In, because this goes directly to this entire story stems out of the attitude that anyone who's ever committed a crime is worth less than anyone who has not, and that is completely false.
No, pretty much all of us commit at least a minor felony every day.
Right.
Yeah.
So, it's impossible not to.
So what are some other facts about Corizon that we ought to be aware of?
Well, the really interesting one to me is, one, you were right. I mean, Minnesota, they're reviewing theirs. State after state. This is starting to catch traction, and that's been the big issue. The reason it's taken so long, in my opinion, is what you were talking about, where the prisoners are the product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people don't see, is people think about it where the Indiana citizen is the person benefiting, right? We're spending less money, it's more efficient, all these things. In reality, those are our neighbors, family, brothers, sisters, everything. And it's what's actually happening is we're just getting a crappier product.
Yeah.
We're getting a used Datsun under a, you know, brand new Chevy Silverado brand, and what's but this is reality. These are people, and they've infected people with HIV by reusing new needles in Arizona.
Yep.
Another person had a hernia in his nether regions that became so large it would take up half the bowl when he sat to pee.
Jeez.
And it was denied. Another person went and had a lab in Arizona. This was all in a report that the ACLU is going to use. He went to have lab work done. They discovered he had cancer. So the lab, though, was not under Corizon. Corizon decided, we're not going to tell him because then we'd have to treat him. So they didn't tell the guy for 7 months until it got to stage four, and then he died a month later.
Jeez.
Yep.
So this is...
These are all case studies.
Government-run healthcare at its finest.
It's like twice as bad because it's... Right. It's like government is administering it, but then there's no oversight, whereas in elections there are. There's no oversight whatsoever. The only way... That's why I say the only way you can get accountability is to sue. Otherwise, they're just going to... Heck, they're going to have the government...
But suing them, it's not hurting them because they're insured.
No, but it can create awareness.
Right. Right.
Because you can do class action lawsuits.
You know, and it also gives you another opportunity, and it gives you more resources to fight with, Woody. I mean, how much can I ask, and if you don't, it's up to you guys if you want to put this number out there. How much, in general terms, has it cost your family a significant amount of resources to sue?
Yes. Our time involved a lot. We're on the road a lot, searching. You know that for 2 years, you know, I've been nothing but searching and phone calls and trying to have meetings and running into brick walls everywhere.
Sure.
Up till she died, we had a lot of time because we felt they were moving her, hiding her. When we got close to her, you know, all of a sudden she wasn't there anymore. You know,
right.
Finding her. We made hundreds of calls, money out to several lawyers to get documents. I mean,
at one point when she was still sick, and at this point she was at IWP, we hired
Indiana Women's Prison,
right? And we hired a lawyer at the county that she had been convicted to try and get her released into our custody, so that we could get her moved out of Corizon and into a real hospital, and we would have paid for it ourselves.
Right.
I mean,
we already paid, you know, money to get it started, and then she died.
So, I mean, and you guys are regular folks. Woody runs the best barbecue stand in the world, and he'll tell you no different.
I don't pay him that much to say that.
you have a fantastic website at flamingwoodbbq.com, designed by a very talented young web director.
Young.
I did it for
How much did you hire those Indians kids for?
But, you know, you guys are not, you're just, no offense, regular people.
Yes.
Trying to fight the government by yourself, and it's hard to do.
It's the hardest thing because we are nobodies to the government. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are low people. We're low income people, so we don't mean nothing to them.
Right.
So the doors has been slammed on us so many times, you know. But they got to understand, I'm old school. You better slam the door harder because I'm still coming.
Yeah, and that's Woody's tenacity is the only reason that, you know. It's just, he's a bulldog, you know, and not everybody has the kind of energy and tenacity that Woody has. So can we talk a little bit about Rachel and her story specifically? Because we've kind of talked the overarching, the 50,000 foot view to kind of give people some context. But let's talk about Rachel specifically and her situation. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about her before she went to prison?
Oh, she loved kids. She was
a mom, correct?
She had lost two children.
Okay.
So she had delivered a little girl and a little boy and lost them both due to her blood disease. That was how they discovered that she has lupus, antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, and ITP.
What is ITP?
ITP is a blood clotting disorder.
Okay.
that, so it's very hard. She has to be very well managed because her blood will either, it will clot very heavily, and she'll start throwing blood clots to her legs, and everyone knows. I mean, this is the cause of strokes, and this is why you have all sorts of issues with your lungs and stuff. So it needs to be well managed, and she was managing it through her hematologist, and everything was fine before she went to prison.
Sure. Now, had she ever been in trouble with the law in any way, shape, or form?
No.
This was a one-time thing.
Even the judge sat there and said, I'm going to hold you till last. So at the end of the day, he told her, he goes, you know, you've been a good girl all your life. You've never been in trouble. He goes, I don't want to do this. But he goes, when you get to where you're going, file for a time cut and I'll grant it to you, which he didn't do it. But
she was a 22-year-old girl that made a stupid decision one time.
Can you tell us what those decisions were?
She sold prescription medication to an undercover officer.
Okay. Do you have any idea why she did that? I mean, why would she?
Well,
we have theories, yeah, but nothing we should probably, you know, put out there.
Okay.
Yeah, she's, you know, part of it is, too, that she, you know, losing two babies.
She was grieving.
Right.
And you when you're young and you're grieving, you make stupid decisions.
Right.
You probably drink with the wrong people or, you know, and someone talks you into it and you think, what can it hurt? I'm going to do a favor for a friend.
Right. So what was her sentence?
Oh, wow.
16 years.
Okay.
On a first offense.
On a first offense. I'm guessing that it has less to do with her individual situation and more to do with sentencing guidelines and being pigeonholed by the state legislature and they're, you know, trying to look good for
campaign season.
Right.
Yes.
Was not the only one. There were others that were involved in the same thing that got a lot less time than she did.
Yeah. She had to do 8 years, and I think the last 8 years was going to be on home arrest, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So, makes a mistake, first-time offense, gets 16 years, you know, non-violent offense. Violent criminals that I know we can't get them to spend any time in jail.
No.
Oh, no. You know? No, it's on the news where, you know, here they've caught guys with guns 1 year, and 2 years later they're on the streets again with guns again.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, so I don't know how they worked that one out. But
the guy that broke into the White House will probably get less than 16 years.
Sure.
Yeah.
So where does she go from there?
She went to, I believe, Rockville.
She went to Rockville.
Rockville Prison.
And she took some classes.
Yeah, she graduated. This is her graduation picture while she was there.
And then they told her that she should do the transfer down to Madison because Madison was it was a lower level and she'd be able to get a lot more classes which would, you know, increase her
accelerate like how quickly
accelerate
she
can be done. So she was looking at getting
what's bad about that though is the only hospital in the state of Indiana that has anything to do with Corizon and their contract is in Terre Haute. Rockville's right there by Terre Haute. Knowing she's this sick, why did they send her clear at the other end of the state as far south as you can go?
So when was the first indication? So she's in prison. How long was she in prison before you both got word that there might be a situation with her health?
Well, an inmate.
When did she go in? When was she sentenced and then started serving time? I guess is maybe to give people a time frame here.
I'm gonna say it was 2011. Okay. I don't have the exact month on.
No, I think it's 10.
I'm sorry, 2010.
Fall. Sometime in May. 2000.
So spring 2010. When do you guys get the first indication that there's something wrong with her health?
The call came in to her mother March 19th, from an inmate.
Of what year?
2012.
Okay, so 2 years later.
All right. From an inmate, called her mother and said that they're taking Rachel out in an ambulance. She's been laying and bleeding through her eyes, ears, and nose for 3 weeks, and they just been leaving her lay.
What facility is she at this point?
She was at Madison.
Madison.
Okay, which is in southern Indiana.
Southern Indiana.
And the inmate told Sue that Rachel had been in Madison and she was in the dog program and she couldn't get up. And they would have to lift her up and two inmates would have to carry her to the toilet because she couldn't walk.
Yeah.
And the guards kept telling she's just faking.
Right.
Yeah, she had these big hives and they call them butterflies.
Right.
When you have lupus. And they were treating her for an allergy.
Okay. So you guys have learned through trying to discover what happened and gathering documents that before that she had been having issues.
Yeah, the documents, when that call came in, the mother called me because she knows I'm really pushy to go get what I need to get.
Right.
And so I called her counselor down there, and the counselor says nothing's wrong with her. She's in her cell. She's doing fine. I said, are you sure? And she said, yeah. She goes, matter of fact, I'll go get her to call you. I said, good. Well, about 3 hours later, she called me back and said, you're right, she's not here. And I said, well, you know, it's kind of funny. I know what's going on at your prison, and you don't.
Right.
And I said, where is she at? Well, I don't know. It's none of my business. Once they leave here, it's none of my business. And that's when the search started. But during this search, we found out she was having trouble. This was in March, clear back in December when all this started.
Okay.
She spent New Year's Eve at the King's and Queen's Daughters emergency room because she was bleeding profusely. And they treated her for 6 hours, gave her two blood transfusions, and sent her back to the prison.
So it was clear that there was something seriously wrong in December of 2011.
Yes.
And going into 2012, it wasn't, by our estimation in reading the documents that you have, wasn't properly treated.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and this is like we tell, you know, medias and politicians that wouldn't listen, they're in between person, you know, you talk to them. And what I have to say, the story I have to tell, is I have the documents laying in front of me to back up everything I have to say.
We're gonna send this to Indiana politicians, and we're gonna ask anyone who's listening to find out if Corizon is in your state, and if you're a Hoosier, if you're in one of these states that has Corizon or a privatized prison system, send this podcast to them so they can hear it, and say just take an hour and a half to hear the story. And if they want the documents, how can they get the documents from you?
I guess probably contact
me, and yeah. I will make sure that if you're a politician in the state that wants more information about this specific story, I'll get you the documents, and I'll make sure to get a CD before I leave here.
Now, are all the documents admissible in the court of law?
Yes, they're part of her medical records.
Oh, yeah, it's all her medical records from day one.
There's additional records we haven't seen yet because it's the prison logs. But everything else is admissible as part of her medical record.
Yeah.
So, for instance, like an inmate calling you, is that admissible as evidence? Will that be allowed?
Yeah, that's allowed.
Okay.
Yeah, because...
Well, so what would have to happen is Rachel's mom will have to testify about the conversation she had, and so will the person
the
phone call.
From that point on, her mother called me. I pushed, and, you know, like I said, I made several calls all over, and they would lie to me, said she's at one place, and she never was there, and, I mean, I did a lot of investigation, hundreds of calls, and, you know.
And there, one of the lawyers that didn't work out did have an investigator that taped conversations with some of these inmates, so there are taped conversations testifying to this.
Yeah.
So you get an indication in March that something's desperately wrong, seriously wrong.
Yeah.
You call down to the facility that you know her to be at, and
She's not there.
So then let's talk about what you're doing, and then we'll talk about where she was at. So let's So at that point, what do you start doing to try and find out where she's at?
At that point, I would call them, then I would call the, because see, the counselor said there's no hospital on any of the facilities, any of the prison facilities. So I'm wondering, okay, if there's an emergency, what happens? Where do you go? So I started calling, you want me to give names or not? Okay, no,
I would say
I'll give offices and then they can figure it out.
Yeah.
Because
putting their names out, it doesn't do us any good at this point because the people who need to know the names, right. Hopefully when politicians hear this, and I'm expecting them to listen, I'm hoping, then we'll give them names here in Indiana so they can go and ask for themselves, you know, and right. Get lied to, allegedly.
That's the way it is. I mean, so I started making several calls to commissioner's office of the prison and getting an answer machine. I'm old school. I don't like machines.
Right.
I don't want to hear your voice. But I left message after message after message and then more messages. So then I tried the superintendent of the women's prison here in Indianapolis. Messages again, probably 15, 20, maybe, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't getting anywhere there. No return calls, no nothing. So I figured, well, I'd try the assistant commissioner. Well, there's a whole list of them. I don't know. Taxpayers going to a dozen different assistant commissioners. I didn't know you needed that many, but,
right.
You know.
Listen, ignoring so, prisoners takes a lot of overhead, okay?
Yeah, right.
Why do you do it? We're not prisoners, and they ignore me.
Right.
So. But anyway, didn't get a response out of none of them. So I called the assistant superintendent there. She responded, and she goes, well, I don't know anything about it. Okay, first thing I tell myself is, you should know. I mean, but she said she didn't. She said call the medical team at the women's prison there. So I called there, and I said, oh, nope, she's not here. I said, what do you mean she's not here? Where is she? Well, nobody seemed to know where she was. I said, well, talk to the counselor. So I talked to the counselor, and he goes, never heard of her. Don't know where she's at. I said, you got to be joking me. I said, what? And if you chose another word, you know.
A little bit of French.
Yeah, yeah. Words that they could probably understand better. Benny says, okay, she's at this hospital here. Well, I thought you said you know where in the hell she was. He goes, that's where she's at. So I called that hospital. Talked to them five or six times. And I said, sir, we don't even know who she is. She's not even here. I said, what do you mean she ain't here? He said, tell me the prison's lying to me. Well, they don't send their people here anyway. So she's not here. So I went through all these phone calls again to all these people.
And over the course of this, what's the time frame?
Oh, geez.
These phone calls are every day.
Every day,
for probably
every 15,
2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, every 15, 20 minutes. I'm on the phone to somebody.
From 7 o'clock till, and he would be at it when I got home at 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah. So 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. And
yeah. And you don't know where your daughter is don't for 2 weeks,
no
and
idea.
No one else does.
No.
And,
well,
and
they
no
did,
tell
but
us.
They wouldn't tell us. So
they kept saying to him, she's fine.
Oh, yeah.
She's in her cell. We heard that so many times. Well, we'll have her call you.
Yeah, this is.
We'll have her call you. Well, she never called.
And then, you look at the documents, she's not there.
Yeah.
She's moved to a different facility.
Right.
Yeah. Now, this is talking to a Corizon's nurse. Would say a lot of things she should know, but anyway, she said that she's not here. So I don't know what to tell you. So I back to the counselor again. I said, listen, dude, you lied to me. I don't like liars. I want to know where my daughter is, and I want to know now. And he said, well, she's at this hospital. Give me another hospital. I said, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. So I called that hospital, went through an hour and a half, 2 hours talking to people there. They never heard of her. So by then I'm kind of short fused. So I call him back and just commenced telling him words that he could understand quite well. I said, I want my daughter found. I want her found now, was my last words to him. Well, later that night, I got a call from a guard. Said, you Mr. Wood? And I said, yeah. Rachel's dead. And I said, yep. He goes, well, she's here. And I said, where's here? And he said that Terre Haute Regional Hospital. She's not doing too good. He goes, that's all I can tell you. And he hung up. So
he acted outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know if that person's still employed?
I don't know. But still, tons of calls were made even after that. Tons. Oh, man, tons. And I was in contact with the doctor once. And one of them shut it off. Corizon shut that connection off.
They found out that he had talked to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor said she only, at that time, had 40% chance. But everybody that we called said
she's doing fine. She's getting released.
Yeah.
So
even ombudsman, that one.
An ombudsman is the person that works for the governor, that works for the
Daniels appointed that person.
Works with the Department of Corrections, or is supposed to work against the DOC. Who is
it's like a union rep,
right? Who is the person who, if a family is in Woody's situation, can call this person, and they're the advocate for the prisoner against the system.
Right.
So tell me about the ombudsman and how helpful were they in advocating for your daughter?
She wasn't. First of all, you had to get through the secretary. It wasn't bad after, 30 calls. I think that's the only reason some people talk to me is because the only way to get them quit calling. But not as made me call more. But anyway, she goes, yeah, I'm going to check into that. And, well, I'm so sorry, sir. We'll get to the bottom of it, and we'll get her found and see if her rights has been violated. So next thing you know, I don't know, they did everything they're supposed to. She got medical attention. No, the proper medical attention here, not medical attention. And she goes, no. Nobody did anything wrong.
Right. So the same answer as the system is giving you, the advocate for your daughter is giving you that answer.
I'd kind of like to see how many reports where the prisoner was right that she stood up for.
Sure.
I'd probably count them all in one hand, maybe.
Now, through all this, you've hired a lawyer, correct, to
several
help,
lawyers that,
assist you. Through that, the course of that 2 weeks.
While she was alive, yeah.
What legal help did you, and that's why you have all these documents, thank goodness, because you wouldn't have access to these documents had you not done that. Right. What was the process that you, how did you get the documents? What did you do to help?
I heard a lawyer, I thought it'd be easier to get a lawyer close to where she was sentenced from. So I got a lawyer out of Fort Wayne, and I was telling him that, while Rachel stayed in that hospital, everybody I kept calling, because they shut my contact with the doctor off, and they kept saying, nothing's wrong with Rachel. She's doing great. Don't you worry about, can I see her? No. Well, they went to the point of making false reports that I was at the hospital with flowers.
Allegedly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said,
so there are reports that you have that show that you were visiting the hospital with flowers.
The Corizon nurse told the DOC, the Corizon staff told the DOC at Rockville. What happened?
Which is close to Terre Haute, which is in...
She was at IWP.
Which is where?
This is in Indianapolis. She was in Madison. She got transferred out of Madison when she left with the ambulance bleeding profusely.
That's in the very southern tip of Indiana, sort of near Louisville.
And she got moved up to Indianapolis, or Indiana Women's Prison, which is in Indianapolis.
Right.
It has an infirmary.
Center of the state.
They said they moved her up there because it had a hospital in the building. It has an infirmary, just like they all do.
Few beds, that's it.
Right. And they don't have a doctor on staff 24/7. Well, they have a single nurse that keeps...
The dog's a little loud. It sounds like you're farting, Woody.
No. Dog's sleeping, snores like Linda.
So they have a single nurse, and when they thought that he was getting too close, when he figured out that she was at Indianapolis Women's Prison, they had her move to Rockville. She failed her intake into Rockville. She was too sick to actually be in Rockville, so they transferred her. They never actually put her into Rockville. They put her in Terre Haute Women's Prison, and Indianapolis Women's Prison put out an escapee bulletin on her.
Yeah.
She had escaped this entire time. She can't walk.
Track of her.
So she has no consciousness. Nobody knows where she's at, so they claim that she's escaped.
She's conscious. Oh, yeah. She was conscious the whole time. She can't walk.
Okay.
She's bleeding that they can't stop. She's in unbearable pain. And they can't seem to fix it.
That's why they loaded her down with morphine,
they
tranquilizers,
gave her morphine and
all
painkillers
kinds of
pain and tranquilizers killers. And anti-anxiety meds. Yeah. And in the entire time,
down,
she's laying in the bed crying.
So from December to the end, essentially what's happening is every time she gets more and more uncomfortable because of what is actually causing the pain, which is the clotting and the blood
the
issue,
lupus.
The lupus. It is, they give her anti-anxiety medicine, and they give her
tranquilizers, morphine, pain pills.
And so she's, just to keep her calm and quiet.
That's when you read a lot of the documents, it goes, well, she's resting calmly. Well, what the hell do you expect all that in you? Of course you're going to rest calmly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
they've
anyway.
They've got her on morphine and Vicodin and Percocet. And
at very high doses.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah, more than what the body's supposed to have had.
I mean, when you read the amounts in the autopsy report and in the dosages at the hospital before she passes away, it's very high dosages.
Yes.
Very
yes.
high.
Yeah, and then we, when they stopped that communication between us and the doctor, again, we're back doing all these phone calls again over and over, and then they... Every time you call Daniel's office, they'd hook you up with this woman's office name. Her name's whatever. But her job is to oversee Horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I was telling Budsman that was that if you were doing your job reading the daily reports, you could see things aren't working and you should have stepped in.
Sure.
But anyway, you couldn't get that lady from that office. I couldn't get past her secretary. The secretary was snob, mean. And finally, how I finally got the woman in charge to call me was that I last message, I said, you know what? The media is going to be all over you on this. Well, it seemed like that word works a lot, even though the media is not. 5 minutes, she called me back.
Sure.
She talked to me like I was a lowlife. I was a burden. There was nothing wrong with Rachel, and not to tell her how to do her job.
Right.
But then her job is to oversee Horizon. You know, so she should be reading daily reports on the people that's injured and sick in the system.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't do that, so Rachel wouldn't be where she, you know.
So the lawyer, how far, you know, his function, his benefit at that point really was gathering all these documents and requesting documents.
And getting Rachel released.
He gathered those documents and he requested them so that we could go to the court and request that she be released. that the judge had sentenced her, give her enough time cuts so that she could be released into our care, so that we could get her moved to a hospital that we could monitor. Because, and most citizens don't know this, but when you go into the prison system, you have to sign over power of attorney. So you no longer get to say whether you're going to take a medication or what's going to happen. You have zero say. And so we just wanted that say back so we could monitor, so that we could do what was best for her.
Because clearly they're not looking out for her best interests.
No, they're not, because...
if they were, they would never have told us that they didn't know where she was.
Right.
So they, so that's what the lawyer did. He got us all the documents, all the prison documents, all the medical documents, and helping us get to the judge. I mean, we were 2 days off from taking it in front of the judge.
So you get the call from the Terre Haute prison system. A guard recognizes that there's just something off. Mm-hmm. Somebody out of the dozens, hundreds, or 100 people that came in touch with Rachel, people within the system, people that work for Corizon, that work for the DOC, that work for the governor's office, whomever, dozens or over 100 maybe, from the course of December to the point in April 13th when she passed away, one person does the right thing and calls you and tells you where she's at and says, something's wrong here. I better do something. I better do the right thing, speak up, and make sure that this family knows where their daughter is. Because I bet they're looking for her, because something's not right.
Right. And I'm sure that he had heard we were looking, because Woody was making hundreds of phone calls, hundreds. We went through 4,800 minutes in April, in like from the 1st of April to the 13th. I mean, so he was on the phone all day long.
Sure. Yeah. So one person in the system does the right thing, which is just stunning. You know, that human beings.
Well, you know, after she passed, I don't know if the guy still has a job. I do know changes were made quickly, within a week. I do know that.
To benefit prisoners or to benefit self-preservation.
I don't know what the changes were, because the ombudsman woman said to me, I'll never forget that either. This told me, she goes, you know what? You've been wanting that meeting with that commissioner. I'll put that together, see, because I can get him to do things that other people can't. So I'll put that meeting you want if you promise not to go after the prison.
Right.
And I said a few chosen words to her and hung up.
Yeah. So if you promise not to fight the system and you just accept it, then you'll get a meeting and that'll make you feel good.
Yeah, but she told me, she goes, that her and the commissioner was over in Rockville with the superintendent and had a meeting that following week.
So she's rejected from one women's prison in Terre Haute, taken to another. They recognize that it's very serious, and they take her to a hospital. What happens to Rachel at the hospital?
Well, at the hospital, they had her on a system where she was, what do you call that, unconscious, doing her breathing and everything for her.
So this is April what?
March 29th. Yeah. Right, she got transferred March 29th to Terre Haute.
Right. Okay, so March 29th, she's at the Terre Haute Hospital. Yeah. And so she's in a coma.
It's an induced coma.
Right.
Well, when I talked to the doctor, I talked to him twice, didn't I? Mm-hmm. Talked to him twice. He was stating the seriousness of it. Trouble with her lungs, trouble with her heart. And she only had 40% chance. They're going to do this test and that test, and then they cut off that communication.
Well, and Woody had talked to Corizon again, and he had said, well, because he kept asking, kept calling the prison and calling Corizon, saying, I want a visitor, I want a visitor.
Yeah,
and
it seemed like Corizon was calling the shots on all this,
They
too.
Kept saying, no, you can't. Yeah. It has to be 30 days. She'll be fine. She'll be released pretty soon.
Have to be dying. Well,
and so he said, well, and he made a comment, because you know Woody. He made a comment to them, and he said, well, what happens if I just show up? Well, 2 days later, the superintendent says, oh, you showed up with flowers and a card to the hospital. Yeah. Now, that was my idea. I said, Terre Haute's a public place. Let's show up. And at the very least, we'll stand in the waiting room and scream her name.
Right.
And she'll know we're there, because she's alone. She doesn't have her mom. She doesn't have us. She has no one.
Now, she had nobody there with her to...
Yeah. And it's clear from the documents that she is in and out of consciousness at certain points.
Yep. So during all this, everybody kept saying she was fine. She was fine. And then I got wind from Corizon, one of the nurses at Rockville, the only nurse at Rockville. They only have one nurse there, these places. But anyway, told me that they were going to, she's doing so well, they're going to release her back into the system. So I totally blew up on her. How in the hell can you release her back into the system? She's sick. Wow, she's doing a lot better. And
she's up and walking around. She's up and walking around.
And she wasn't.
And the medical records from the Terre Haute Hospital reflect that is complete falsehood.
False, right. And so I got a hold of the superintendent there, and I said a few chosen words, And she goes, "Mr. Wood, I don't know what you're talking about." She goes, "I never heard of Rachel coming back to this prison." I said, "Well, then you better have a talk with that nurse." And during that time, a nurse from, where's that third place?
Kindred.
Kindred is the private hospital that she's...
Kindred's a rehab hospital. Yeah, it's an LTAC,
it's a place
long-term care facility.
It shouldn't even been brought into this because they can't take care of Rachel.
It's like a hospice. So anyway, when you're terminally ill, that's where you go, or if you have a long rehab.
So the nurse said they're on their way to see Rachel. I don't know why she called me before, but I said, okay. And then I told her what was all going on. She goes, "I'll do what I can do." At that point, seemed like a nice lady. When she called me back and said that she's crying, she goes, "I've never seen anything like this." She goes, "Oh, my God." She goes, "You need to sue these people." And I said, "What's going on?" She goes, "I tried to get them to release her to me." And the doctor was on the phone with Corizon. Well, I can give you the name they were talking to, but I won't. But Corizon, I said, "So Corizon's still calling the shots?" She goes, "Yes." Corizon wants her out of there. And she goes, "I'm telling you, by the way it looks to me, it's all about the dollar. Like, they've done spend enough money there at that hospital on her, so they're trying to get her out of there."
So they're trying to release her from Kindred and take her to...
Was still at Terre Haute.
She's still at Terre Haute.
Had gone to Terre Haute. Someone from Kindred had gone to Terre Haute to do an assessment whether they felt that Kindred would be able to take care of her.
Okay.
Yeah, and Kindred...
Which is what happens with an LTAC situation.
And then this person is calling you saying, "This is a very bad situation."
Yes, it was really bad, she said. And... she goes, this woman's name from Corizon said, "Well, it's up to the board. It's not up to me." So later that day, she called me back. She goes, "Well, they approved it. They approved it. They're going to let her come to Kindred, and you're going to be able to see her because we're going to let you see her." And I said, "Okay, when's it going to happen?" And she goes, "Tomorrow." So when tomorrow came, superintendent from Rockville called and said, "Mr. Wood, I went and seen your daughter last night." She goes, "Too many conflicting stories are going on. I had to see for myself." And she goes, "I think you better go see her." I said, "Our 30 days aren't up." She goes, "Oh, yeah, it is." But it really wasn't. I said, "Are you sure?" And she goes, "Yes. You need to go see her. Now, keep in mind, when you talk to her, when she tries to talk to you, you got to lay your ear right on her lips." So that has to be on her lips because you're not going to hear her.
Sure. At this point. She's so weak.
Yeah. So I hung up and called her mother. And I said, hang on, let me call you back. And this was about noon or one, somewhere in there.
What day is this?
This is the 13th.
Friday.
Okay.
This is the Friday.
Okay.
Called the Rockville superintendent again. I said, no. Called Rockville, and that nurse got on the phone. And I said, are you letting us see her because she's dying? Oh, no, there's nothing wrong with her. She's doing great. Don't you worry about it. You go see your daughter. Okay. Next phone call, she's gone.
And that was about 9 o'clock that night.
She, her last words was, I'm doomed, and she died.
So essentially what happens is they release her, and they're taking her to another facility.
What happened was she coded twice, right. And they were still going to release her.
They tried to, according to the medical records we saw, they discharged her on the 12th, the day before. And then she coded. So they had to cancel the discharge and do two transfusions that night, that day.
Even all of her medical records saying she's having all these troubles, they were still discharging her. And Corizon.
What did she have? What was going on medically? I mean, we know the complicated blood disorder, but it had gotten to a point, and it had caused what?
So what had happened was when you have a blood clotting disorder, and anyone who's ever had a stroke will know this, they treat you with blood thinner. Well, they had given her so much blood thinner that she couldn't clot at all now, so it's running from her orifices. She's bleeding
lungs
out of
filled
her
up.
Her lungs filled up. She's having trouble bleeding.
All her stomach.
So she's bleeding. They can't stop it. And they're not really doing anything. And every time she complains, they just give her another pain pill.
It was a horrible death. And she was alone.
And then...
in handcuffs and shackles.
On the 13th, they were going to transfer her to Kindred. Now, typically, she's on a breathing machine. So typically, they leave it all hooked up. She was unhooked up in Terre Haute for 5 hours before the ambulance showed up.
Yeah,
this is all in the ambulance report. The ambulance, she started having problems. You know, Terre Haute's over an hour away. She had problems 10 minutes into the run, and the ambulance chose to just keep coming instead of going back or going to an emergency room somewhere.
Yeah, at that point, they're taking her to Kindred, and they show up, and they...
Kindred don't even have an emergency room.
No, and so they get to Kindred, they pull into the parking lot, and that's when she goes into cardiac arrest.
She had been showing signs of it before they even
before
put
they
in.
Even got there.
So they were trying to resuscitate her in the parking lot
Of Kindred.
To the point
that doctors there are saying, "Why did you bring her here?"
Yeah, that's all in the reports. Doctors are screaming at him, "Why did you bring her here?"
Right. Why did you not take her to an emergency room?
Wishard Methodist are 2 minutes away.
Right.
From Kindred.
Right. So they're bringing her from Terre Haute to Indianapolis. And there's several hospitals right there.
Yeah, they were having trouble 10 minutes into the run.
You know, and Terre Haute is an hour and a half drive.
Yeah.
See, these decisions were made by Corizon.
That's what I'm wondering. Did the ambulance driver even have the authority to take her to Wishard, too? Another hospital, because I know that's the issue, is that they have cut what they'll pay.
Right.
They've cut so much that the hospitals just say, no, we won't admit anyone.
But they are medically bound as EMTs to take, in the case of a critical emergency, to take them to the first available level one trauma.
See,
the first available when they're in that badly. And you know what? Wishard was the state-run hospital, so regardless of the contract with Corizon...
Yeah, they dropped their contract with Corizon.
They
Wishard
cannot
was.
Deny treatment.
That's why all those girls are having to go to Anderson for the pregnancies.
Yeah.
So the official cause of death, according to the autopsy, is cardiac arrest, but also a full-body hemorrhage.
Right, there's miss...
Therapeutic misadventure.
And it wasn't until we met nearly a year later that I had a friend who had gone to medical school that somebody who could explain this this to you guys. You know, it's...
We knew something bad had happened.
You knew,
right?
You knew,
like, you know.
Just not the specifics of what
we didn't know how long it had gone on or how bad it was, how much they ignored it.
That's why I think most of the politicians, you know, they knew what happened and they just wanted to avoid me. They didn't want to...
Yeah. So, all right, let's... Because we left on a very heavy moment. So, she passes away... How were you guys notified?
I was sitting in here.
The Rockville superintendent called him.
Called me.
And I was in the other room, and he screamed my name, and he dropped the phone. And she told me she had passed away at 9 o'clock.
So... I'm not laughing. It's a difficult story.
It's a very difficult story, and it's a heavy moment. I mean, it was probably the single worst moment him and I have had together.
Sure. So what do you do at that point? I mean, other than grieve, I mean, as far as turning your eyes towards justice for Rachel, I mean, does it start immediately? Because it's very...
You know, before we get to that, what was so okay. also so upsetting, you know, she was, I guess probably the wrong term, she was state property. So they come up to your doorstep and say, "Watt, here, we killed your kid, now you go bury him."
Right.
I mean...
Yeah, they basically said...
Oh, they signed her off as soon as she died. I mean, they signed her off immediately because I called the...
Where do you want us to send the body? You need to bury her.
No, they said pick her up at the...
So how was there not... Did they do an autopsy or did you guys push for that?
We asked.
We requested one and then...
And Corizon tried to get that too.
And I
strictly told them... There's no copies go to nobody.
Who did the autopsy and they tried to get the copies from that entity? Who did the autopsy?
Was it Marion County?
Marion County did the autopsy. We had requested from Kindred that they send it directly to get an autopsy, which is their standard procedure. When the first autopsy, and then we called the Marion County coroner. Woody called the Marion County coroner and told them that because she's now our property, Corizon doesn't get a copy.
And they said
the state doesn't get a copy.
Corizon were on the list to get a copy. I said, no, they're not.
Right.
You tell us that it's our responsibility that she's now ours, then she's ours.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So, and the autopsy is really how we have pieced together. Like I said, I mean, we're sitting at a table nearly a year later, probably 360 days later, and we're talking to this friend of mine, and they're outlining for you guys the specifics of what happened, you know, and reading the autopsy, and that's how, you know, the documentation, the forethought that of all that just is incredible because it has given you a fighting chance, it's given you closure, because without any of that, you guys wouldn't know anything.
No.
You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable to me.
The lawyers were surprised. They were amazed. Like, where in the hell did you get all this? And I just told, it doesn't matter. I got it. That's all that matters.
I mean, it's changed.
I mean, I did majority of their work.
Right.
You know, so.
And then you would think that it would be easy to find a lawyer.
No.
To take That's this hard. Case because it is so complicated and because the state's involved and everything else. It actually took us a while to find a lawyer that A, would take the case and B, we could trust.
Yeah, because your search for lawyers, you have to think about it. This is not just you, it's not Joan Rivers where Joan Rivers goes, gets a procedure, and there's one doctor messing up. This is a complicated system that tries to cover its tracks with dozens of people coming in contact with your daughter at multiple levels. Each one of them have to be interviewed. You have to build this enormous case, and then you're up against unlimited resources. And then in a city the size of Indianapolis, there's like three or four lawyers that will do a civil rights action lawsuit.
Right. Well, I mean, and you said it best, Chris. 100 people have seen her since she first got sick, and one did the right thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're up against. One out of 100 doing the right thing for her.
But, the process even got harder afterwards. So.
Oh, they're going to shut down completely.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm sure they have procedures, and they actually probably even have seminars on how to do things correctly in the event they do something wrong, so they have the, you know, reasonable doubt.
But Chrysan's calling the whole shot. Chrysan's calling her to leave that hospital.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no doctor in their right mind would release her when she's just coded. Come on.
How do they have authority? That's definitely in the contract with the state.
All right.
That has to go.
It is we, the taxpayers, we, the voters, that are giving them this authority through our legislature.
And it's not negotiated by us because they sit. I was reading about how they come to terms, and they sit down, and essentially it's a bit like a constitutional convention or a contractual negotiation. They want certain terms with the state that they know they will be able to limit their legal liability and maximize profit.
And you're
so
right.
It's they go back and forth.
About profit, yep.
And so this is definitely one of those things that has to go out of that contract.
Because, you know, every nurse and doctor that you've put in that lawsuit and anybody that works with them, they're all going, like Greg says, to classes to figure out how to minimize their risk, which means we're gonna give worse care to the people that we are. They're wards of the state, which means we are, as voters and taxpayers, responsible for the lives and welfare of people like Rachel Wood and the people that are currently serving time. And it is so easy for you to say, oh, well, they're just a criminal. But Rachel wasn't a criminal. Rachel made a mistake. And Rachel went to a system that didn't look out for her best welfare. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you don't do anything to the dog. I'm giving this motivational speech, and the dog is chowing down back there behind me.
It kind of tells you a little boring here, huh?
I guess. Thanks, Woody.
It's the dog, my friend.
But, you know, if you're listening, this is, it's just like the drone strikes in Afghanistan and other places. We're complicit if we do nothing to stop these sorts of things.
We absolutely are. What shocks me is that one person out of 100 did the right thing. And I feel the same way about government as I do about Chrysan. I mean, I feel like it's the exact same thing. It's government with even less oversight. It's not competition. It's not the right, you know, it's not the private market. It's a government-sponsored entity, but there's no oversight. The ombudsman definitely doesn't do their job, and neither does the commissioner. So how did Hoosiers, or how did just individuals get to the point where they cared so little about another individual that 99 out of 100 people wouldn't say a word when something went wrong?
And it was life and death.
It wasn't, you
know, for $350 million, why can't Indiana do it themselves and save a lot of that tax money use it elsewhere?
I've been watching a lot of Hitler documentaries on Netflix, and you watch the footage of this guy giving speeches and Goebbels giving speeches in front of these huge at the Sports Palace and all these massive arenas, and all these people are just happy, and you just go, there, you can't tell me that people in Germany didn't know that these things were happening, because when Goebbels yells about we're going to shut the mouth of the Jewish press, they all go, yay! I mean, this is an evil system. This is a system that those people who did nothing that are part of the system to save their jobs are out of self-preservation, are participating in evil. And the people who, because this story is too long and it's too complicated and it's too hard to tell the story, you know, this is not an easy podcast to listen to, I'm sure, and it's not easy for us to sit here, and this is the third time I've sat and gone through the story intimately, and it's still very tough. But we have to be faced with the evil of the system that we have allowed to be created in our name.
Yeah, and, you know, why hasn't, and again, it's going to be like a recording, why hasn't the prosecutor stepped up and at least investigated this? Because, again, if something happens to my child here, I'm held responsible because the child is in my care.
Right.
So what gives government officials and what gives Corizon the right to do what they want without paying the price for this. And I'm not talking money.
Right. What gives them super rights?
Yeah.
What makes them different than you, Woody? So what are things that you'd like to see happen? What, you know, the lawsuit is to speak their language, and it's not necessarily something that you want, but it's something right. that a few of us have talked you into.
Yes, yes. You know. And
what do you, if you win the law, I mean, maybe we shouldn't talk about that, but moving forward, how do you fight for your daughter? How do you fight to make this right?
I want to get a foundation put together first, you know, in Rachel's journey. What I want and would be happy with is somebody held accountable, not with money, the justice system. Let them go in front of the judge, in front of a jury, and let them decide you were negligent, you were responsible, you're covering this up. You know, and be held liable for what they've done, you know. And again, if it was you and a child, you're going to jail.
Right.
You're at least going to go in front of that judge. But no prosecutor will step up. No politician don't want anything to do with this because, you know what, they think it's just going to blow away. And that's the whole thing. Corizon knows it's going to blow away. The government knows it's going to blow away. So
their contract just got renewed.
Yeah. So why come up with a system and don't give them another contract? You have plenty of time to do this in. It's not like you can do it overnight. So look, whenever their contract's up, you got all this time to do that. Come up with a system. A lot of that tax money can be back here in Indiana where it belongs and used for something else.
Yeah. Linda, what would you like to see happen? I mean, what is moving forward?
I would like to see the people that let this happen to Rachel actually have to sign over their own power of attorney and spend some time in the very system that they helped create. Because then they'll know what it is to be powerless. And you making a mistake should not make someone completely powerless and at the mercy. I mean, Rachel should... It was a single mistake. 16 years was a lot, but the rest of her life was just unimaginable.
Right.
That, to me, I mean, that's entrapment. Undercover officer trying to purchase drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That should be gone immediately. That should not be allowed to happen ever, in my opinion.
Kind of like entrapment, but...
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, and that's and part of what gets lost in the story, because it is a story. We're focusing on the justice system and the criminal system. When you're inside, let's not forget how she went there, you know, and the laws that we've created to put people like Rachel into this situation.
That's not even who people would want in there.
Right.
If you had everyone meet her, and you put it up to a direct vote, there's no way. I think that would be 80% of criminals.
You take somebody in her stage of mind losing children, and you wave money underneath their nose. Of course, they're going to jump.
And you solicit them
say, hey, I need a favor. Can you just give these to another friend of mine?
Right.
You should never be coerced
into
a crime.
Right.
And
then on top of that, the sentencing, the judge would not have given her that time had they been given a different option. And I know of a case where had a judge been able to give a person more time and more penalties for their behavior, a violent person, they would have. But they didn't because they couldn't, because they're pigeonholed. I mean... And
the minimum sentencing laws have to go as well.
And we want to look at that and we want to say, oh, well, you know, it's rights for those who perpetrate crimes. We want to protect them by making it even and fair. But that's not justice. It may be fair, but it certainly isn't justice that these specific cases where you have these violent criminals get 10 days in jail and 2 years of probation, and then a Rachel Wood gets... 16 years, that's not justice. That's insane. That is politicians trying to get votes by looking tough on drugs and other nonviolent offenses.
I mean, public opinion has just bastardized the system completely.
Right.
It's unbelievable, really.
I mean, you let these people go, all these big powerhouse companies are going to be able to do what they want. And they're doing it now. Somebody's got to step in and stop them. Somebody's got to step into the government and stop them.
Right now, his last name's Lemon. He's the commissioner of the Department of Corrections.
That is correct.
He will be the next employee.
Yep.
Guaranteed. Of Corizon.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yep. That's the one that I probably left millions of messages.
He'll be the next, I guarantee you, he'll be the next regional director of Corizon Health.
You've been doing some research while we've been talking over the last
And he's been
hour
ignoring my daughter while she was alive.
So, well, not Greg, the Lemon, but listeners might think that Greg was ignoring Rachel. But what are some of the things that you, while you were doing some research on the fly here, what are some things that you found, Greg?
Well, Susan Hoppe, am I saying that right? Hoppe, she was appointed by Mitch Daniels, 25 years as a caseworker and social worker.
She's the ombudsman.
Ombudsman. There's quite a few articles about she's too soft, doesn't care enough. She's kind of the bitter social worker that's lost a little bit of touch. That was a lot of the concerns. And her record keeping was atrocious. That right now, at September 7th, the new ombudsman.
Oh, there's a new one?
Mm-hmm, was just, she quit on in May.
Hoppe quit in May.
And I can't find anything on her anywhere. I don't know what she did. That's what I wanted to see, is who she got hired by. But the new one is right now being investigated or being questioned by the Indiana Congress, the House. And the committee is asking for record keeping. And they testified that there are hardly any records. They don't even have a count of the number of children that are in the system.
Jeez.
For the... I forget the name of the organization, but essentially foster care and then child welfare services. They don't have a list of every individual. That's how bad Susan Hoppe was at record keeping.
That's unbelievable. Well.
And so I look at that because this whole story I hear, and I'm livid at Corizon. I'm livid that, one, I don't even know what you call it, because it's definitely not privatization, because there's no competition to offer better services. And yet that's what it's called. And two, the people in government roles didn't do anything anyway. Because if anyone's going to have a feeling of justice, a feeling of that you're representing someone on behalf of the people, it's someone in a government position that's taxpayer funded. Because right. Every dollar you pay goes to making sure that you have oversight of Rachel, and you didn't. And what legal recourse do you have?
And what just chills me to the bone is that the system has not changed. It continues. And how many other Woodies and Rachels are there out there? Not everybody's like Woody, you know, and not everybody's going to do what Woody's done and has the ability to do what Woody's done to try and fight for his kid. And how many other Rachels are there out there that don't have a Woody on their behalf because there's nobody else looking out for them, you know? And it just, that's the most frightening thought out of all of this
is that what we're doing here, if we can get succeeded, that means we're looking for them out for them as well.
Yeah. So go ahead, Greg.
Another interesting thing is that you talked to how many attorneys do you think you reached out to?
Wow.
Like 60, 80?
I would say at least 45.
At least 45.
Yeah.
We met, Not including the one that we hired before the team we have now.
And
we
the team for that one, and then the team for that one.
Well, Chris has met with us with, what, three or four?
Three or four, yeah.
But we've been to almost every attorney in Indianapolis. We've called them, or we've been there, or we've tried to get them engaged.
And I imagine like only a few you thought were like capable of handling it and willing to?
Well, each one of them would pretty well say something different, or some of them would say something close to the others. Well, wow, this is a real complicated case. We can only do malpractice, maybe. I said, well, I dropped the documents off 2 weeks ago. You had time. You could have read them. So there's no maybes because everything's in black and white. And number two, her civil rights. I mean, the government was supposed to protect her and oversee her, you know, and everything that's happening with her. And they refused to do that. What's the problem?
And we actually had two attorneys that said, well, you have a medical malpractice case, but I don't think you'll win in front of a jury because she's a convict.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Not only they said that, the assistant superintendent, when I finally got to talk to her, she goes, well, how'd you find out? And I said, well, an inmate called. Oh, you mean a convict?
Yeah.
You can't believe a convict.
Can't put him up there. Can't accept that testimony. That's my concern.
And I said, if I can't believe a convict, then where in the hell's my daughter?
Right.
Why haven't I got a phone call? Why?
Who's telling the truth and who's not?
So where do I go to see her? You're the assistant superintendent. You tell me.
So is the team that you guys are currently working with, is that somebody that came from one of my recommendations?
One of them, yes.
Okay. If Woody hadn't, I have been a part of the political system in Indianapolis for 10 years now. And I went to a lawyer friend of mine, a libertarian lawyer, gave him a 5-minute debriefing on what the situation was. It's complicated. I asked him for 3 recommendations. And he's very well connected in the legal system in Indiana and here in town. And that's how they got a recommendation. So again, to get anything done, you've got to find an advocate who can kind of understand and help you navigate the system to get what you need, which is crazy. And I don't mind doing that at all, but it shouldn't be that way. It's so frustrating and maddening when you've got something that, you know, I don't have a law degree. I have no desire to ever be a lawyer. I don't have, you know, I'm just a person with common sense, and I sat down and read the documents. And within an hour or two of looking over what you guys have,
and we have hundreds of sheets.
Clear what happened. And so for a lawyer to say after 2 weeks that, oh, it's very complicated, I'm not quite, I mean, it's a total bull.
It is. It's, my question is, a lot of your paperwork you have received, has any of it come maybe like from a guard or someone reaching out?
We haven't seen any of the prison logs yet.
Yeah, we haven't seen none of the prison logs.
Every guard, every shift has to do a log. And we haven't seen any of those, especially for the time that she was in Terre Haute Hospital.
We know the guards that were in her room, has to be in her room all the time. You know, the nurses, anybody, they're the ones that fed her what she could eat.
Right.
That was the guards.
We haven't seen those. All we have seen was the medical records that the lawyer we hired prior to her passing away. And with the case, we're right in the middle of discovery. So we should be seeing it at some point, and we haven't yet.
Yeah.
I would just say do everything to the T, because they'll come after every technicality imaginable.
Oh.
Like that showing up with flowers.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I'd want the video of that in the hospital immediately. I'd want my credit card statements proving I was, you know.
Where'd you buy the flowers? Where's, you know, it just, so the story is not done, and you're 2 years out, and who knows how much longer both cases are going to take. I mean, it's just a very long and involved process to fight the system, and it just,
I think I'd probably get faster results if our politicians would listen and step up. The prosecutors, if they'll listen and say, you know, maybe we should investigate this. Because these people knew, I can take the prosecutor's records and they'll see it was neglected.
Well, there's a difference between civil and criminal. I mean, civil, it's two parties trying to argue your case. And in a criminal case, it is the weight of the government and the force of government coming down on you, and you have to defend yourself at this point. It's, you know, it's guilty until proven innocent. Anyway.
Right. It's, it says that. They knew. They knew all along and just ignored it.
The crazy thing is there is so much evidence.
Yes.
And they're not being charged or investigated for more than what Rachel did.
Right.
You know, it's just insane to me. So,
well, they also probably negotiated their procedures and decision-making process and got it approved.
Right.
So, like, when they decided to just keep taking her from Terre Haute to Indianapolis, I would bet that now, like Wishard or someone would have had to take her, but those EMT, they wouldn't have been reimbursed. So they wouldn't have sought payment.
Right.
And then there would have been repercussions down the line. And one, man, that's so tough that, I mean, I can understand it. It's just, that has to be reformed. There has to be a system, a systemic audit of the decision-making process if they're going to keep this system.
So many of the behaviors of everyone involved in this story is manipulated by government policy. There is a law or a policy that has been passed by our legislature, enacted by our governor, that causes the behavior of these people in this story to act against their better nature, to act against their conscience, to act against what is decent for another human being. And when we talk about the dangers of growing the government too large, it isn't hyperbole. It isn't ranting and raving. It is human cost. When you are interfering in the interactions between two people by enacting a law, you are causing certain outcomes. And these outcomes are unacceptable, and they are totally preventable because we are interfering in the affairs of human beings to the point that they're acting in it's evil what has happened to Rachel.
We are so alienated from each other by systems like this. It's unbelievable to think two EMTs are sitting there watching someone die and their lungs filled with blood, and the only thing they can think about is, we'll probably get in trouble if we go back. Like, what has happened to society? And to just, you know, sitting at a table, talking to people, how could you feel that way about a person ever?
Well, and right. I just want to bring up that, and I know a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, they're suing and they're going to get money. We wanted to sue, and the big reason that we agreed to it is because because it becomes part of the public record. So right. Then everybody know it is it happens.
Sure.
What we would love to do, what I truly think would make someone listen, is if we could force them out of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
If they lose their contract because of stuff like this,
now that's
then we've
them
actually
in the
hurt them.
Right.
Yeah, because they don't have insurance for that.
All right, well, let's wrap up here. We always give everybody an opportunity to kind of go over what we might have missed or say their final piece on the show here. Greg, final thoughts, final questions about the story that we haven't covered.
You know, it's funny. I've been battling with, especially from a libertarian perspective, I battle with the privatization, if that's a good thing, bad thing, more efficient, and then I battle if the state had administered everything, how it would have worked out. And it's absolutely impossible to tell, but I feel like she couldn't have gotten worse care.
She couldn't have gotten worse care under a government system, frankly.
Nope. It's impossible. She could not have gotten worse.
Yep.
And
she'd be alive if the government would have looked at those records and said, you're not doing something right. You need to change and let's go the right direction.
And without a doubt, whoever has power of attorney has to have more rights than they do right now, because you barely got access. You got lied to. You had no recourse. You couldn't even go see her.
No.
They'd have used that in a medical malpractice suit to disprove your character, and then you would have lost for sure. And they already tried to by planting a lie.
Right.
There has to be a fundamental, almost Bill of Rights for power of attorney for people within the, taken care of by the justice system, that you have immediate, like, I don't want to say remediation because there's no getting reimbursed or giving her back, but
no.
You have to have a certain patient or a certain rights as her power of attorney.
Yeah. There needs to be an ombudsman that does their job. Just at
even if the ombudsman would have did their job.
Right.
Because
open door policy for sure.
And I think what I'd like to, I'll say my piece, but so for each of you individually or together, I mean, final thoughts, things that you'd like to get out there. And after everything is done legally and everything is out there, we're going to come back and talk to you guys. We can give, you know, with the court records, we want to give Corizon's story. We want to give the state story. They're not, if we call, they're not going to talk to us. You know, they're not going to give an interview for this podcast.
We just renewed our contract there.
Right. You know, they're not going to sit down and give us their side of the story. So when that is all over, we'll look over the court documents and give their side of the story as honestly as we can. So as soon as that is all finished, we want to have you guys back to kind of wrap that up. But in the meantime, what are some of your final thoughts that you'd like to get out there?
I'd like to see a more transparency. So, you know, we shouldn't have had to search for a month. It shouldn't have been the night before she passes away, someone telling us she's actually in Terre Haute and she's not doing very well. It should have been right off the get-go. We took her out, you know.
They already have her in shackles and handcuffs. Why not have a tracking device on her ankle?
Sure.
Well, she couldn't walk.
Well, she couldn't walk.
I mean, but like, you know, have something where you know where they are, even, you know.
Yeah, she couldn't walk.
You know, so that whole but thing, transparency would have made a big difference, because we would have taken the time, instead of spending 11 hours a day trying to find her, trying to find out where she is, we would have spent that 11 hours a day with her every day.
But see, their policy was, after so long, they're supposed to contact you, in which they didn't.
They never did. They never did. I don't know exactly what the policy is, but it's something like serious illness or something they're supposed to contact.
24 hours.
24
or, something
or 48
like that.
Hours.
Yeah. They have windows based on severity.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Woody?
My thought is, you know, if we can get enough signatures on a petition to get these prosecutors to say, okay, you know, we're on board. We're not saying run out there and arrest somebody, but, you know, if they're responsible, let the judge decide, you know, and then remove Corizon from, you know, the state. A lot of tax money they're going to be using this state, because the state does it themselves. They're not going to spend $350 million, you know, so.
I would actually say I don't want them to go in front of a judge, a jury. A jury of losers.
Yeah. You know, I'll let them feel what Rachel, you know.
A jury of regular people in here, the story.
Yeah.
Their side and ours.
But, you know, that's about it. And, you know, Chris, I was never about lawsuits to begin with. It's something that you said the best way to hurt them, you know, is their pocket. But finding out they're insured, so we're not going to hurt them that way.
Well. Hopefully, at least we've got public record.
Right. That's correct. I mean, I don't regret what you've said and what we've done. But I think, you know, let's just treat them like they would, like the government would treat me. Mm-hmm. They would have me arrested and get you a lawyer. And...
I think from my perspective, we'll talk in the next episode a little bit about... the way the criminal justice system ought to look. You know, it's not our style to just kind of leave you hanging and not give you some solutions. But, you know, this has been a tough one, certainly out of, this is the 92nd episode. That's certainly, the first time we've ever gone in depth and shown you the human side of politics. I mean, it's politics is about human beings and their interactions, and the policies that we enact have real human costs. And we have to be mindful about that, and especially as libertarians, because we're all so analytical. We're all programmers and, you know, accountants. We don't think emotionally a lot of times. We think if we do A, B will happen, and then C will be the outcome. But that's just not the way that the world works. So we need to be mindful when we're in the voting booths in November and when we're talking to politicians, these outcomes, the things that we've learned through this story about the real human costs of our government policies and what we allow. And I know that people listening to this podcast, it's preaching to the choir. But, you know, double your efforts. Do more. Because it's just imperative. Lives are at stake. And we're not just talking about young Pakistani children that get killed by drones. We're talking about children in your hometown.
Killed by people you voted for.
Killed by people that you see in the grocery store because they did nothing. You know, it's evil. And we just can't accept it anymore. And you've got to have the same passion about making change that Woody has. Now, Woody's motivated by so many more things, mostly and centrally a father's love. But we need to be motivated by what's right. So take this, share it, send it to politicians, send it to candidates, get their perspective on it. See if they have humanity left. I mean, plain and simple, do you have humanity left in your soul? So thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Libertarians, and we'll
thank you guys for telling the story
and
so much.
Thank you guys
for having us in your home.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
So, and if you're in Indianapolis, please look up Flamingwood BBQ. I'll give my plug to Woody. He makes a mean barbecue. The brisket's amazing, but it's all good. So come out. If you're in the Indianapolis area, I don't know if you're still cooking this summer, and you want to meet Woody on Fridays and Saturdays from 11 in the afternoon on at 116th in College. 106th in College. You'll see a barbecue stand Fridays and Saturdays, weather permitting, at 11 a.m. on until he runs out of food. Stop by, grab a bite, say you heard the podcast, meet Woody for yourself. You'll be thoroughly disappointed when you meet him in person. I'm just kidding. So Woody will give you a hard time, but you'll enjoy the food. So, all right. Thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Libertarians. And until next time, we'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.